Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to tonight's show of Jump Right In, a production of 1111 Broadcasting. My first mistake today was turning on my computer and looking at the news. It just started flying at me, left and right, no pun intended, on one thing after another, igniting my mind, stirring my emotions, burning out my keyboard. That will be tonight's show. If you read today's blog post, you noticed that it was twice as long as usual. That's tonight's show. Unfortunately, the time we have is not going to be twice as long, so I'm not sure how much we'll get into it. You know, I was going to just get an egg timer, set it for about 7 minutes per topic, and when it beeped, just stop talking about that. But I can't do that. If you know me, you know I can't do that. So I'm not sure how much we'll get to. Whatever we don't get to will be pushed off to next week's show. And, of course, I was going to get back to Obama's budget items that I missed there, and I'm just not going to have time tonight. Anyway, this is Splash, and my pond is open. We had a great show last night talking about my favorite soap opera, As the District of Columbia Turns. Tonight we'll start with Brian Williams because, well, I want to. Then we will turn to taxes, public vote buying, Netanyahu's upcoming speech, weapons of mass destruction, the evil that is ISIS, and if I have time, the lame duck exit stage left that's starting to happen. I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun with that. So much to cover, we cannot possibly get to it all, but we must try. So the number to call is 215-383-5730, and I encourage you to jump right in. Wade carefully if you must, but remember, in my pond, everyone swims at their own risk. We'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. And if you want to chime in, just give us a call. I promise not to bite unless I think you'll enjoy it. Now we now have a blog, so our shows are posted there, past, present, and future. Go to 1111broadcasting.com. I'm even putting pictures in there now. And you can listen to a show, make a comment or suggestion, or just say hi. You can also follow me on Facebook, 1111 Broadcasting. All shows are posted there, so you can listen right there on your Facebook. Now, if you miss a show, don't sweat it. Of course, you just go to a show link, listen on the blog or on Facebook, 1111broadcasting.com, or the Facebook page, 1111broadcasting. All one word, of course. You can jump right into the show chat room tonight. You'll need a free login from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Just put in an email address, pick a screen name, pick a password, and voila, you can jump right into the chat room, pick on people, or even pick on me. Now, if you want to participate in the show, put your stamp on tonight's episode, wade right into my pond then. By all means, dial the number right there at the top of the show page, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. I would love to talk to you. Put me to the test. It'll be your time to shine. Now, before we get into tonight's show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. I took my family to Choice Mattress, and everything was considered from the weight of our weights to our age, to our height, to the way of each of us sleeps. The right mattress was personally selected for each of us. Now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year, 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like other stores. Chances are, if you bought a bed in the Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, then you bought it from David. With over 20 years of experience, David knows beds. And you should see all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located at the corner of LPGA and Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. If you just have questions, David's always happy to answer them. Give him a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. The number to call to join into the show, 215-383-5730. And I wanted to jump into this hoopla about Brian Williams apologizing for his false Iraqi story. Of course, you know the NBC nightly news anchor, Brian Williams. He apologized Wednesday for falsely claiming that he had been aboard a helicopter that was shot down during an invasion of Iraq in during the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The Stars and Stripes is where this report is coming from. On Friday night's broadcast, Williams cited a terrible moment a dozen years back during the invasion of Iraq when the helicopter we were traveling on was forced down after being hit by an RPG. Our traveling NBC News team was rescued, surrounded, and kept alive by armored mechanized platoon, by an armored mechanized platoon from the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry. Now, remember that description, folks, because that seems pretty specific, doesn't it? Our traveling NBC News team was rescued, surrounded, and then kept alive by an armored mechanized platoon from the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry. One crew member responded to the story on Facebook the following day, writing to Williams, "Sorry, dude, I don't remember you being on my aircraft. I do remember you walking up about an hour after we had landed to ask me what happened." This week's crew members of the 159th Aviation Regiment Chinook helicopter also told Stars and Stripes that Williams had not been in the shot-down helicopter, but had arrived an hour later. Arrived an hour later. On Wednesday, Williams conceded that he was not on board the shot-down helicopter, but he told Stars and Stripes he did not intentionally make the mistake. I got to tell you, pretty descriptive for getting the plane that he was on wrong. I would not have chosen to make this mistake, Williams said. I don't know what screwed up in my mind that caused me to conflate one aircraft with another. How many things in your brain have to go wrong in a row for you to make this kind of a mistake? So, I mean, that right there is unbelievable. Although his apology, both on Facebook, which is kind of an impersonal way to make an apology, but being a new Facebooker, I'm kind of starting to begin to see that that's just the wave of the future, impersonal contact. So sad. But anyway, Brian's apology both on Facebook and Wednesday night on NBC's Nightly News, while it seemed heartfelt, was also just a bunch of lame excuses to explain away his embellishment of this story. Now, I'm not going to read the whole apology, just a couple of excerpts, because it's just thoroughly laced with excuses. Anyway, this is Brian Williams now, because I have no desire to fictionalize my experience. But you did. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Brian. Because I had no desire to fictionalize my experience, we all saw it happen the first time, and no need to dramatize events. I just got to call bullshit on that. You're a journalist. Sensationalism is your game. The least you could do, Brian, is be honest in an honest moment like an apology. Anyway, so no desire to fictionalize, no need to dramatize the events as they actually happened. I think the constant viewing of the video showing us inspecting the impact area and the fog of memory over 12 years made me conflate the two, and I apologize. Excuse, yada, 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 this kind of thing happened, the other threat ever, and okay. The irony is, this is Brian Williams again, in writing up the synopsis of the 2 nights and 3 days I spent with him in the desert, I managed to switch aircraft. Okay, so you somehow, which plane you were on, you forgot which plane you were on, while one was hit by enemy fire and yours wasn't. You have to admit, folks, this is kind of hard to swallow. But Brian goes on. Nobody's trying to steal anybody's valor. Quite the contrary. I was and remain a civilian journalist covering the stories of those who volunteered for duty. This was simply an attempt to thank Tim, our military, and veterans everywhere, those who have served while I have not. Okay. Williams has told the story several times, including during a 2013 appearance on The Late Show with David Letterman. Brian said on Letterman, "Two of our four helicopters were hit by ground fire, including the one that I was in, RPG and AK-47. We were only 100 feet doing 100 forward knots," he told Letterman. Look at the detail he's remembering. "We landed very quickly and hard, and we were stuck. Four birds in the middle of the desert, and we were north out ahead of the other Americans." It's a lot of detail. This is the embellished version, of course. It is hard to imagine that such a metamorphosis of truth could be due to the fog of memory over the last 12 years, especially to a journalist who is supposed to report the facts. Didn't he take notes? "I was on this plane, I was on that plane," or "I arrived an hour later." Look, folks, I know what storytelling is. I have been known to embellish a story from time to time. It makes for an even better story. But that's storytelling, spinning the yarn, yakking the yak. This is the news. Should Brian be disciplined? That's up to NBC. CBS disciplined Dan Rather for his rush to judgment on George Bush's so-called draft dodging. They fired him. And Dan was more powerful in CBS circles than Brian is at NBC. Now, I'm not saying to fire Brian. I like the guy. He is, as journalists go, a great journalist. And plenty of people have fictionalized accounts without losing their positions in life. Some of them even go on to be the front runner for a major political party for president. I'm sure we all recall Hillary's account of her harrowing account of landing in Iraq with bullets whizzing over her head. Come on, we all embellish our stories from time to time. It makes it more exciting, makes it stand out. It captivates the people that we are engaging more fully. But here's what Brian did. He's right. There was no need to fictionalize his true story. No need to dramatize this already dramatic event. What Brian forgot was that in the world of journalism, he is not the story. Iraq was the story. The crew members were the story. The attack on their convoy of choppers was the story. Brian was not the story. Journalists are just there, capturing history. And through all the sensationalism, they should at least try to keep it real. If a journalist is beheaded, then they become the story. If their reporting is censored, then they become the story. If their phone conversations are wired by the government, then they become the story. But if they are just along for the ride, then they are not the story. That is what Brian forgot in the fog of memory over the last 12 years, and I am sure that he will learn from it and become an even greater journalist than he already is. Wanted to talk about Brian Williams because the bottom line here is, folks, They are supposed to report the news. They're not supposed to tell us what may happen eventually in the future. What happened? Especially if you're giving us an accurate account of an event, what happened? So anyway, I want to move along to Obama's tax proposals in his new budget. They are extensive. We won't talk about them all. We can't talk about them all. But we will talk about some of them. If you want to talk about these, the number to call, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. President Barack Obama, of course, you know his latest budget is his most populist ever, seeking big tax hikes to pay for ambitious new spending on education and infrastructure in a dare to Republicans to find common ground. Well, I'm sure they'll find some. Here are the biggest and boldest among his tax proposals. All estimates are revenue raised or spent are over a 10-year period. So, just letting you know, these are listed, by the way, in an article in Politico. So, the first one, of course, my favorite, the Buffett rule. Of course, you know, Warren Buffett griped that he pays lower tax rates than his secretary. He griped. because ordinary income is taxed at higher rates than capital gains. This is all about capital gains and its lower tax rate. And you know, the funny thing is that here in this article, it says the current tax rate for capital gains is 25%. I Googled it and it said it was 15%. So I don't know, maybe that was years ago. But in any case, the White House wants millionaires to pay a minimum tax rate of 30%. Now, this is, by the way, an effective tax rate of 30%. So that's what they want it to be, and I want to talk about that specifically. The contrast between taxes on wages and investment was highlighted during the 2012 campaign when Mitt Romney's relatively low tax rate became an albatross for the Republican candidate. Now, by the way, his tax rate wasn't relatively low. His effective tax rate was relatively low. And that's the important factor here, and we're going to talk about effective tax rates. This particular rule, and now it's estimated by the White House that this would raise $35 billion over a 10-year period of time. So this would raise $3.5 billion per year by White House estimates. I really, you know, the way I see these estimates, they never raise what they intended. Because these rich people, these rich companies, they all have teams of lawyers, teams of tax advisors, teams of accountants that are going to help them do with their income what they need to do to pay a lesser rate. So anyway, according to the White House, it'll raise $3.5 billion a year. It's the ultimate tax focused solely on the rich. Warren Buffett, he's some slick dude, takes credit for suggesting something that you're never going to pay. First of all, let's recap. Buffett's secretary must be well compensated, and rightly so. She's the executive assistant to the richest man in the world. Buffett says he paid an effective tax rate of 17.4%, which was, according to him, a lower effective tax rate than his secretary had. Now, we don't know what the secretary made. That was never disclosed. We don't know what her income was, but she would have had to have been well compensated for her overall effective tax rate to be higher than Warren Buffett's. According to the Tax Policy Center, people who make between $100,000 and $200,000 a year are paying around 20% in federal taxes. That's their effective tax rate, including payroll and income taxes. And that's very important, including payroll and income taxes. So Buffett's secretary, if she's compensated in the $100,000 to $200,000 range, isn't all that far off from Warren Buffett's effective tax rate. Of course, if we looked at the actual taxes Buffett's paid in total dollars, they would dwarf the taxes that his secretary paid. But that's not the point here. We got to pick the numbers that work best for the Smurfs. So that's what we're doing here. So it's important to understand what an effective tax rate is. It is your total tax bill divided by your total income before all of your deductions. So in other words, if you take your total income, including your capital gains, including your regular income, including everything else, that's all your income. And then you divide that by your total tax bill after you've taken off all the deductions, all the, you know, whatevers. That gives you your effective tax rate, which is always lower than the tax bracket you actually fall in. So there's two different things here, but the effective tax rate was what they're talking about. So it that's what that is. So does the lower capital gains tax drag a Warren Buffett's or a Mitt Romney's effective tax rate down? Of course it does. But that doesn't include the double taxation that the investment money charged capital gains has already been hit with. I talked about this double taxation on capital gains taxes in an earlier episode of Jump Right In. So yes, the capital gains rate of 15% or 25%, you know, I haven't even been able to put my finger on it. I've been too busy all day. It does really drag the wealthy person's effective tax rate down. But do you know what drags it down even more? Or should I say, actually, it drags the average schmoes, or not to be disrespectful, Warren Buffett's secretaries, what drags her effective tax rate up? So it's not so much that it drags the effective tax, although it does drag the effective tax rate of wealthy people down. This same tax drives the effective tax rate of the average person way up. It's the most regressive tax in existence today. I have spoken of it on numerous occasions, FICA. What is amazing to me is that liberal regressives, the champions of the middle class, the Smurfs, touters of middle class economics, do not attack this tax as anti-middle class. Maybe that's because it funds their social programs that they love the most. Maybe not. But the bottom line is that this is the most regressive tax in existence today. FICA hits the middle class worker the hardest by taxing all income under $110,000 per year. So if you make less than $110,000 per year, it hits all of your income. Every dollar over $110,000 avoids this tax, and no wages under $110,000 avoid this tax. This is how Warren Buffett's secretary pays a lesser effective tax rate than Warren Buffett himself. In fact, if we repealed FICA, just got rid of that tax altogether, Warren Buffett's effective tax rate would barely budge, because $110,000 is so little compared to his total income. But his secretary's effective tax rate, provided that Warren Buffett pays her between $100,000 and $200,000 per year, would plummet to 12.7%. You would shave 7.3% right off of that. So the lower capital gains tax isn't the real culprit here. But admittedly, it does. If it's at 15%, it does lower that effective tax rate. And if it's at 25%, it still lowers it just a little bit. But the reason liberals like the Buffett rule so much is because it doesn't lower taxes by providing middle-class tax relief, but it punishes the rich so that the left can say to the middle class, there, we got the bastards for you, while at the same time supposedly confiscating another $35 billion over a 10-year period from the nation's investors. And it's not a whole lot of money, folks. When you're talking about $3.5 billion in total for these people, but that's not the point. The point here is the class warfare that's going on, the reason that they're doing this, and the actual – and it's all about slapping capital gains and raising more revenue that they can spend. Obama's budget is $4 trillion. He has to justify that in some form or fashion, and he's trying to justify that while at the same time capitalizing on his class warfare. The reason Buffett likes this Buffett rule so much is because he knows he'll never pay it. Neither will most of the rich people, while he basks in all the glory of as an enlightened oracle from Omaha. Now, I'm going to skip the limited itemization deductions for the wealthy. The government says that would raise another $64 billion a year, $640 billion over the next 10 years. So, yay. Capital gains, maybe I'll get back to that one day. I don't know. But the capital gains one I wanted to talk about, but I talked about that, the capital gains last night and on even previous shows. But other than the double taxation, which capital gains is, if we do the Buffett rule, isn't that technically a raise on capital gains taxes already? I mean, that's the whole justification for the Buffett rule to begin with, right? I mean, left? I mean, the whole reason they want to institute the Buffett rule is because capital gains are taxed at a lesser rate than regular income. So it actually, the Buffett rule is a raising of the capital gains tax already. It's built right in. And yet they want to raise capital gains as well to add another $208 billion over 10 years. So now they're where $3.5 billion wasn't all that much, here's another $20 billion a year. So that now we're up to almost $25 billion a year on capital gains that they're trying to scarf out of our economy. Now here we go. I want to get into this one because this one's important. It means a lot to a lot of people that may or may not be in need. Expanding middle and low income family tax credits. Let's read these off. The administration's plan would expand the child tax credit. Now, they're talking about tripling it. That's what I saw. from $1,000 to $3,000. It would expand the earned income tax credit for lower-income workers and create a new $500 second earner credit. The new provision is aimed at married couples, particularly those with young children. I qualify. Well, I'm not young, but I qualify. Who may feel it doesn't make economic sense for both of them to work. So it gets the second person out there working if you offer them supposedly this $500 second earner tax credit. The credit would phase out with income, though couples earning up to $210,000 could claim at least a portion of the break. So it starts at small, $500, and then as you get closer and closer to $210,000, it starts to phases out. The other provisions would expand the earned income tax credit for childless workers and triple the tax credit for working families that pay for child care. This would cost $277 billion over a 10-year period of time, so $27 billion a year. Of course, I don't call tax cuts costs. To me, that's just us taxpayers saying, look, you got less to work with. That's not a cost. A cost is an expense, something you lay out money for. This is just simply a cutback in revenue for the government. To me, that's not a cost. It's not an expense. It doesn't really go for anything. It's something that we keep in our pockets because it's our money. But there it is, folks. The mass vote purchase. Not that I wouldn't benefit from a lot of this stuff, but it's not going to guide my vote on who I vote for. But the bottom line here is that's what this is. It is a mass vote purchase. It will cost us $277 billion for these people to hopefully vote for Smurfs. But Obama sandwiches it between two great big layers of get the rich class warfare. So it feels good. It's like a Dagwood. It's like Dagwood made them all a great big envy sandwich. Make no mistake, folks. I do not want to pay more taxes. I want to pay less taxes. But I think we should all be paying less. If for no other reason, then it gives our government less money to waste. Forces them to find better ways to spend our money, cheaper ways to spend our money, more efficient ways to spend our money, and even all the while getting the same thing. I talk to a friend of mine all the time about how we know. If we gave us the budget and a pencil and a calculator, that we could do the exact same things for a whole lot less money. That's the bottom line. Our government does everything. I have never seen government get involved in anything that didn't become less efficient and more expensive. Give me a call. Name me one. 215-383-5730. What I don't like, is this pitting of one class of Americans against another. If the rich people all took their ball and left tomorrow, took everything they had and just said, you're right, we're so tired of being beat up on, we're just going to cash out, move to the south of France, toodaloo. They're doing this at about 2,000 citizens per year are doing this now, mostly over tax complaints. So raise your hand if you've gotten your job from a poor person or even a lower middle class person. It's not likely to happen. So the bottom line here is I don't like pitting one class of Americans against another in order to get yourself some political clout, to buy yourself, actually, a political clout. Now, taxes on multinational companies. We talked about this one last night. Worst idea ever. And not because that we don't want that money to come home and be taxed. We don't. We do. But it's the way you're doing it. First, taxing that money without requiring repatriation is ridiculous. They called this in this article repatriation, but that's not what it is. Encourage multinational companies to bring that money home. Second, their global operations do not have to be U.S. corporations. Inversions like the one Warren Buffett financed for Burger King are just one way to go about that. These companies are already paying whatever corporate tax that their foreign countries charge, and many of them use those foreign profits to reinvest in those global operations. Obama sees the benefit of lowering taxes on corporations here at home. Surely he understands that we will get less revenues out of that corporate tax if we drive more companies beyond our borders. They do not have to be American companies. They don't. The one-time repatriation tax, that's not what it is. They just want to tax them at 14% of whatever money they're holding out there, without even requiring it to come back and even in some way have a chance of helping our economy. That would raise $268 billion. Now, that would be in 1 year because this is a one-time thing, so it's not spread out over 10 years. So a one-time tax of all the money that's out there of 14%. You know what? How much is that? Getting out my little calculator made in China, my $3 calculator made in China, $268 billion. Divided by 0.14%, that means there's $1.9 trillion in money being global profits being kept outside of this country. Bush brought $360 billion back in one tax holiday. That's how you do it, folks. $360 billion came back into our economy. Now, we talked about that. I mean, I'm not really sure there's all kinds of fights about whether it created jobs, whether it didn't create jobs. They cite companies that got repatriated money that still laid people off. Who knows? Maybe their layoffs would have been bigger. Maybe they just didn't care. A lot of stockholders got that money. But the reality is stockholders are Americans. Stockholders spend money. Stockholders create commerce. Man. Repatriate the money. If you're going to tax it, require it to be repatriated, not just kept offshore. And, of course, that would raise $20 billion a year for the 19% tax on global profits that Obama wants to do from here on out. I mean, and you know what that's going to do, right? That's just that 19% will be on top of whatever they're paying in corporate taxes to the other country. Require them to repatriate it at a very reasonable amount, and they will repatriate not all of it, but some of those dollars back into our economy. The bank tax, I like this. This one, you know, kind of funny, actually. The plan would be to impose a 7 basis point fee on the nation's approximately 100 banks, just 100 of them. The administration says it would force them to think twice about borrowing heavily. That's primarily how the tax is based. Thank you very much. That was my son telling me dinner's ready, which I won't get to eat for another hour or so, or less, maybe. Who knows? Anyway, this would raise $112 billion. Billion dollars. That's $11.2 billion a year. Unless, of course, these banks end up thinking twice about borrowing heavily. Then it raises nothing. So you see, here's the problem. Obama just wants Congress to pass his $4 trillion budget, and he's willing to propose taxes he knows that even if they pass, would not raise the money his administration is projecting. At the same time, he wants to buy the middle class tax votes with goodies while convincing them that it won't raise the deficit. And even if they don't believe him, he's betting that they don't care about that much about the deficit as they used to. But just in case, Obamahood is telling them how much he will steal from the rich and give to the poor. So he's not going to raise taxes on the middle class. Wait, what? What? What's that you say? Read on. Okay. What is this? Ooh, a tobacco tax again? The administration proposes to nearly double taxes on cigarettes and small cigars to about $1.95 per pack from the $1.01 per pack and index that tax for inflation. So as the price of taxes go up, so does the tax. Oh my God! You poor smoker. You got to get killed by cancer and taxes. It's crazy. The hike would pay for two politically powerful initiatives, an extension on the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is due to end this year if Congress doesn't extend the funding. Now, remember, just so you know, because this is all part of this discussion, way back when Obama was a brand new president, the first tax that he put into play was the $1 increase on tax on cigarettes to pay for the extension of the CHIP health insurance program, which was supposed to, I don't know if it did, supposed to eventually insure 4 million more children. So, right? I mean, you all know this, that only rich people smoke, right? Most smokers are 95%ers. Many of them are middle classers. And what did Obama say way back when he was running for president the first time? 95% of you will not see your taxes go up one dime. Did he say, unless you smoke? Not that I recall. So that's middle class economics. Got it. Here's the thing, folks. I don't like our tax structure. It is ridiculously high, even at the low end of the progression. It is loaded with advantages, political payoffs for the big boys of the big business world. And that makes it harder for ambitious up-and-comers, new competition, to make a real go of it. So if you want to attack those advantages, take out those political payoffs that the politicians have given to their special interests, then by all means, go ahead, knock yourself out, take your best shot, but have at it. But don't use tax policy to pit one group of Americans against another, to make mass voter purchases or the mass purchase of votes, or wage class warfare for your own political benefit. And that is what Obama is doing. We will not realize the tax revenues the White House is estimating, and the cost of the mass purchase of votes will be greater than the estimate. You want an example? Well, hold your horses, folks, because here it comes. But before I get into that fine example of how much a mass purchase of votes can cost, when it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. My whole family is now sleeping on beds from Choice Mattress, and you cannot say enough about the benefits of a great night's sleep on the right mattress chosen specifically for you. Now, Choice Mattress, with over 20 years of experience, David knows beds, and check out all the other fine furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress Furniture, located at 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. That's on the corner of LPGA and Nova Road. Now, if you just have questions, just give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. So if you want to jump in on this discussion about taxes and mass voter purchases, the number to call, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. Do you remember how the Obama administration, way back, reformed the student loan program by cutting out the middleman, banks, thereby creating another revenue source, a direct revenue source for the federal government? This proposal was intended to take aim at young voters and get them out in droves in support of Smurfs. It was a double play for the Smurfs. Buy the votes with lower interest rates, lower payments. Remember, they were capping your payment at your 10% of your discretionary income. And also shorter loan forgiveness terms. Make your payments for 20 years instead of 25 years, and we'll forgive the balance of your loan. While at the same time, so it was just not just buying of votes, but at the same time, it was cutting out banks and dumping revenues directly into federal coffers. Do you remember that? Now think about what I just said, where we never realize the estimated revenues. And the cost, and that the cost of vote purchases is always higher than what was first told. With this comes an article from Politico, and this was the first article I saw today. In obscure data tables, buried deep in his 2016 budget proposal. The Obama administration revealed this week that its student loan program had a $21.8 billion shortfall last year, apparently the largest ever recorded for any government credit program. That was the cost. Actually, that was just the down payment on the cost of this mass purchase of votes. The main cause of this shortfall was President Barack Obama's recent efforts to provide relief for borrowers drowning in student debt, reforms that have already begun to reduce loan payments to the government. That's what that $21.8 billion revision represents, folks. The reduction in loan payments to the government. Not the total amount of loans. Total loan payment, just the loan payments. For more than two decades, budget analysis have recalculated the projected cost of about 120 credit programs from the federal government every year, but they have never lowered their expectations of repayments this dramatically. The $21.8 billion revision, larger than the annual budget for NASA, and larger than the combined budgets of the Interior Department and the EPA, the combined budgets of those two. This $21.8 billion revision will be tacked onto the federal deficit. Wow, marveled Steve Ellis, the vice president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Whether or not it's good policy to help borrowers with their payments, it's obviously costly for the taxpayers. Right there, folks, when they make a play to purchase en masse the votes of whatever group they're targeting, in this case, young kids aiming for college, the cost is obviously huge. For the taxpayer, we're the ones that pay for that voter purchase. Us, we are the ones. The $40 million, and by the way, some of us that are paying for that voter purchase, our votes can't be purchased. Not by money, anyway, not by gimmies, not by goodies, only by ideas. The 40 million Americans with student loans are now saddled with more than $1.2 trillion in outstanding debts. Can you all understand why banks didn't really put up a big whole fight to keep the federal government from taking this on? Anyway, with higher education costs rising much faster than inflation, that deserved a triple repeat. The already massive program has been growing at a spectacular clip. Direct government loans alone increased 44% over the last 2 years, despite an aura of austerity. I love how they say that, aura of austerity, in Washington now, because it's not really austerity, but an aura of austerity in Washington. The Obama administration has tried to ease the burden for some borrowers by reducing their payments to 10% of their income, and not their income, folks, their discretionary income, and forgiving their loans after 20 years. This year, the Education Department plans to make all borrowers eligible for that pay-as-you-earn relief. All borrowers, past, present, and future. These were the terms of this mass, that's what you call the consideration, if you will, in this verbal contract between young college people and the president. So anyway, let me tell you why higher education costs are rising at a much faster rate than inflation. Isn't that weird? Insurance rises at a much faster rate of inflation because of a lack of competition. That's it. You take the consumer out of the picture, and they have to buy whatever insurance that somebody gets at some business. That's it. That's for most part. Or you get Medicaid, or you get Medicare, or you get TRICARE. You get one of those. Other than that, those are you are limited. There is no competition. That's why prices of one of the reasons why healthcare, the cost of healthcare and the cost of health insurance have risen much faster than the rate of inflation. Well, the same is true of higher education, kids going to college. I'll tell you why. This is because the government will loan students whatever is necessary for them to attend college. There is no limit, none. This is the problem with people not paying for their own stuff. Son's in the room, couldn't use the word I wanted. Their own stuff, or being not being responsible for their own loan payments, the full payment, or even thinking about what the cost will be down the road when they have to start paying it back. It is a cultural problem combined with a bureaucratic nightmare that higher learning institutions are taking full advantage of. That's the reason that higher education costs are rising at a much faster rate of inflation. Borrow whatever you need, pay it back later. Nobody's looking at the finer problems, but I digress. Student loan default increased somewhat last year. So this really wasn't about the defaults so much as it was simply a reduction in the payments that were being repaid. But the department says the primary drivers of this unprecedented re-estimate, budget wonk jargon for the update of expected loan costs, were Obama's policy changes, the recent ones as well as the upcoming ones. And because of a quirk in the budget process for credit programs, the department can add, get this, because of the quirks in the budget process for credit programs, the department can add the $21.8 billion to the deficit automatically without seeking appropriations or even approval from Congress. That's a big quasi-bailout, increasing the deficit nearly 5%. The White House Budget Office was unaware of any larger re-estimate since the current scoring rules of credit programs went into effect in 1992. As a January political article featured on the government's unusual credit portfolio reported, the Federal Housing Administration has struck more than $75 billion worth of similar re-estimates on Uncle Sam's tab over the last two decades, most of them after the recent housing bust led to a cascade of FHA-backed mortgage defaults. But that's over two decades, folks. They've never had a one-year shortfall quite this drastic, and this $21.8 billion for student loans was in a single year. It's not yet clear whether this will be a hefty one-time revision or a harbinger of oceans of red ink as millions more borrowers get relief on their payments to the government. It's not yet clear. You really don't think that there's going to be more and more and more people that are going to take advantage of this year after year after year after year after year? Several reports by Barclays Capital have warned that Obama's generosity to borrowers could leave the student loan program as much as $250 billion in the hole over the next decade. And behind closed doors, officials in the White House Budget Office and the Treasury Department have criticized the Education Department's models as overly optimistic, with some officials pushing internally for third-party audits. Yes, overly optimistic loan models, because this is the nature of a mass purchase of votes. You marginalize the cost of it to sell it to those whose approval you need, Congress's. But the administration officials say there's no reason to think that this year's shortfall will recur. There's a big surprise. They believe that their budget going forward will accurately reflect their new efforts to help borrowers limit their payments. That pay as you earn will be baked into the cake. Get that? Baked into the cake. Do you know what that means? That means that even if they do have the shortfalls, even if they have the shortfalls, they're going to be covered numerically with liberal math by something else. Historically, re-estimates for better or worse, have tended to cancel each other out across government. In fact, this year's government credit portfolio increased to $3.3 trillion. The government's credit portfolio is $3.3 trillion. Did you all know that? I did not know that. Larger than any U.S. banks, but the re-estimates for all the programs besides the student loan netted out to less than $1 billion. So in other words, $1 billion in the hole for all of the other programs – I don't even know why they're using this as a defense. And $21.8 billion for one. So all the other loan portfolios netted re-estimates of $1 billion. But this mass purchase of votes rang up 21 times that amount. Nearly 22 times that amount. The administration argues that even the 21.8 billion dollar student loan shortfall is a relative pittance for the Education Department's $740 billion book of direct loans. The second largest government credit portfolio after FHA mortgage guarantees. Any re-estimate should be considered in this context, said White House Office of Management and Budget spokesperson Emily Kane. Look, I'm no economist, but I'm pretty sure that I get this here. So for two things. Number one, $740 billion book of direct loans. That's the total amount of loan obligations. That's the total amount of the loans. That's the portfolio. The $21.8 billion was a re-estimate of just the payments. So this Emily Kane is taking it out of context, comparing apples and oranges, the reduction in actual payment amounts to the actual obligations of the total loan portfolio. That's out of context. What are the total payments, Emily? I would like to know. Anyway, the other thing is, let's suppose that they are apples and apples in comparison to the $740 billion book of direct loans. Okay, until it happens every year and that amounts to $250 billion in the hole, like, wait, I'm scrolling up, don't leave me. Said that it could cost as much as Barclay Capital. So if it happens to end up being $250 billion, that is a little different, isn't it? That's one-third of the portfolio. Of course, if it's just half that amount, it's 1/15 or so of the portfolio. Come on, folks. This is a third of the portfolio if it gets to that amount. This is why government sucks, folks. They will take a $21 billion warning, and call it, wait, what did he say? I want to get it right. Oh, yeah, a relative pittance. $21 billion, a relative pittance. Equivalent to the budget of NASA, a relative pittance. Equivalent to the budget of the Interior Department and the EPA combined, a relative pittance. Man, government sucks. That's all I got to say about that. Oh, let's jump overseas now, shall we? I was just reading this article this morning because it was talking about our stockpile of chemical weapons, in particular mustard gas, that we had missed, or sarin too, mustard gas and sarin, that we had missed the deadline for eliminating. First of all, I didn't know we had this particular type of WMD. Secondly, I didn't know that there was a treaty to destroy them all worldwide by 2012. So I was interested. Then I came across this little part that made me do a double take. Wait, let me see. All the way down here. Here it is, way down the article. After a nightmarish gas attack in World War I, a 1925 treaty barred the use of chemical weapons, and the 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention set a 2012 deadline to eradicate them. Four nations that acknowledged having chemical weapons have missed the deadline: the United States, Libya, and Iraq. And here I am on Fox News article, and that's all they said about it. Just a mention. Anyway, folks, we had a technical difficulty there. I really don't know how long that technical difficulty was going on, but we were talking about Iraq and the actual realization that I came to today that they actually had chemical weapons that were found in 2006, mustard gas chemical weapons, that they weren't supposed to have. But anyway, that led me to further investigation, and I found that another group had just recently gotten their hands on those chemical weapons. And so I was getting into that article from Press TV. It was an article from December 2014. Iraqi Deputy Foreign Minister Mohammed Jawad al-Duraki made an announcement on Monday at the annual conference of the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in Hague. The Iraqi army during the past period has recovered the Mathana site and roads leading to it, he told delegates. Now, this is a site where they had these chemical weapons. This is the site. This is where they were found. So he told them that they had recovered the Mathana site and the roads leading to it. Recovered? You mean they lost it? The ISIS militants who took control of the area during an offensive in June could not penetrate the facility's fortified bunkers, he added, saying that the government's forces flushed out the terrorists from the compound. They were there for 6 months, folks, since June. ISIS had control of this compound since June. Yeah, this is a real JV team. Well, they did lose it back to the Iraqi army, so there's that. But two sealed bunkers in the facility hold stockpiles of the old chemical rockets and equipment. Al-Duraki said a facility established to eliminate the chemicals had been plundered and the area had been mined. Military engineers are now working on removing the mines and explosive devices from around the site of the region, he pointed out. In a letter distributed to the UN on July the 8th, Iraqi's ambassador to the world body, Mohammed Ali al-Hakem, said that remnants of 2,500 chemical rockets filled with the deadly nerve agent sarin are kept along with the chemical warfare agents in the facility. Again, they had the weapons. This is the part that's surprising me most, that nobody's making a big deal out of. Here is Iraq saying, we missed the deadline. Whoop, they got the control of the site. Whoop, we got it back. And maybe it's just because it's old news. I don't know. I just find it shocking. He singled out the capture of Bunker 13 and 41 in the compound, 35 miles northwest of the capital. Based on a report by UN inspectors, Bunkers 13 contained 2,500 122-millimeter sarin-filled chemical rockets, along with about 180 tons of sodium cyanide, which is very toxic chemical and a precursor for a warfare agent, Tabun. I'm not really sure I said that right. T-A-B-U-N. Bunker 41 also held 2,000 empty 155-millimeter artillery shells contaminated with the chemical warfare agent mustard, 605, one-ton mustard containers with residues and heavy contaminated construction material. You got that? Chemical warfare agents. Correct me if I'm wrong, but CWs are WMDs, right? And Iraq had them, and they lost them to ISIS. And ISIS had control of them since June. Yikes. Okay, let's stay with ISIS for a bit. There's one great opinion piece on Politico by Rich Lowry that I wanted to share with you all. It was called The Return to Evil. Where did my show notes go? There they are. It was called The Return to Evil. He starts out with, where is Chris Kyle when you need him? You know, the late hero of the movie American Sniper made no apology for killing as many members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the precursor of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as he could get in his rifle sight. After the burning alive of a captured Jordanian pilot by ISIS, Who would object to Kyle or any other American sniper shooting down these murderous fanatics if he could get any access to them? And who would quibble with Kyle's characterization of these people as savages or even damn savages? Perhaps NBC News correspondent Ayman Mulyadeen would still denounce Kyle for his racist tendencies and killing sprees as he did on the air the other day. But most everyone else would welcome the late Navy SEALs bringing his cold-eye professionalism to bear on ISIS. And so would I, by the way. We need to show these damned savages what jihad really is. Part of what is part of what the left finds objectionable about Kyle is his unshakable moral certainty that he brought to this fight. In light of ISIS's spectacular advertisements of its own cruelty, though, Kyle's point of view holds up very well. It is becoming practically an international norm. These are quotes now from international leaders. This evil can and should be defeated, a spokesperson from the Jordanian government said after the execution of its pilot. The foreign minister of the United Arab Emirates spoke in a similar key. This heinous and obscene act represents a brutal escalation by the terrorist group whose evil objectives have become apparent. So did the British Foreign Secretary. The latest depravity will only redouble the international determination to eradicate this evil that is ISIS. Here at home, Morning Joe on Wednesday did a segment on ISIS labeled Evil Acts of History, comparing its depredations to those of the Nazis and other barbarous killers. The ISIS beheadings last summer marked the return of the rhetoric of evil, because no other word quite suffices for beheadings, crucifixions, and now immolations. Violent extremism, the administration's phrase of choice, our administration's phrase of choice, obviously doesn't capture it. You can pile on the objectives, hideous, savage, heinous, and still not get at the willful malevolence of caging a man and burning him alive. In his first statement after the horrifying news of the pilot's fate, President Barack Obama said the act reinforces the viciousness and barbarity of ISIS, which he repeated must be, what else, degraded and ultimately defeated. We talked about this on last night's show, folks. Degraded and ultimately defeated just isn't good enough. It isn't. Obama added that whatever ideology they're operating off of, it's bankrupt. And here's the best line in the whole op-ed. Argentina is bankrupt. Radio Shack is bankrupt. ISIS is evil. Obama has used the word evil about ISIS on other occasions. It was noted that in his speech to the UN General Assembly last September, the president sounded like George W. Bush. It was noted that he sounded like George W. Bush when he insisted there can be no reasoning, no negotiating with this brand of evil. Throughout his presidency, Bush made unapologetic use of the word evil to describe our terrorist enemies and caught hell for it. On the left, it became a given that Bush's reliance on the word spoke to his manifest unsuitability for the presidency. The controversial ethicist Peter Singer wrote a book titled The President of Good and Evil, Questioning the Ethics of George W. Bush. Needless to say, it wasn't an endorsement of his ethics. Glenn Greenwald wrote his own tome title, A Tragic Legacy, How a Good Versus Evil Mentality Destroyed the Bush Presidency. It became a trope that Bush was just like his enemies in his fearsome certitude. Bush critic Ron Susskind approvingly quoted commentator Bruce Bartlett, who unburdened himself of this deep thought. Bush believes the Islamic radicals can't be persuaded that they are extremists driven by a dark vision. He understands them because he's just like them. University of Chicago professor Bruce Lincoln wrote of Bush and Osama bin Laden. Both men constructed a Manichaean struggle where sons of light confront sons of darkness, and all must enlist on one side or the other without a possibility of neutrality, hesitation, or middle ground. I guess he was referring to Bush's comment, you're either with us or against us in the war on terror. Bush and bin Laden were exactly the same, except that one unhesitatingly ordered the hijacking of civilian aircraft to crash into skyscrapers, and the other unhesitatingly described that act of mass murder as evil. It smacks of religious worldview that it is this. It smacks of a religious worldview that makes secularists uncomfortable. the word evil. It doesn't necessarily entail any particular policy response, but it tilts towards a total commitment to fighting the enemy, since a campaign to degrade and ultimately destroy evil feels inherently inadequate. If Bush was ill-served at times by his stubbornness and certainty, it's always worth remembering Democrats were perfectly content to lose to al-Qaeda in Iraq when Bush was ordering the surge in 2007. That, by the way, folks, was quite successful. And Obama's also, his insistence on pulling out of Iraq entirely was a priceless boon for ISIS. Obama was allegedly the embodiment of the wholly different approach than Bush, much more nuanced and sophisticated than his predecessor and his embarrassing nomenclature of evil. Yet Obama's doubts were more about his usefulness and goodness of the American power than about his own purposes. He pursued the end of the Bush-era wars at all costs, regardless of the depravity of forces on the ground who would benefit. We were supposed to be beyond good versus evil, although the other side didn't get the memo and never left the field. It's almost as if the greatest trick evil ever played was persuading the left not to call it by its proper name, evil. You know, you all know what I think we need to do about ISIS. What do you think we need to do? 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. And I want to stay in the Middle East, sort of, and talk about this speech of Netanyahu next month before Congress. Because it's, it's just a speech. But Israeli Ambassador Ron Dermer and Knesset Speaker Yuli Edelstein rushed to meetings on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, trying to calm all the furor created by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's planned speech to Congress next month and quell a Democratic revolt that has dozens threatening a boycott. Of course, Their pleas fell on deaf ears. If anything, Democrats finished the day more frustrated. According to sources in the room, one Jewish Democratic member of Congress even accused Dermer of being insincere when he claimed not to have anticipated the partisan uproar he ignited when he skirted protocol and went around the White House and scheduled the speech with Speaker John Boehner. Folks, it's just a speech. White House Press Secretary John Ernest, meanwhile, dangled the possibility that the White House would have Vice President Joe Biden skip the speech in what the West Wing acknowledges would be a serious snub. I wonder about the wisdom here. You know, 70% of Jews vote Democrat. And I'm not sure that they're going to vote Democrat just because the Democrats claim to be supporters of Israel. But there are deeper reasons why American Jewish community votes Democrat. I was going to talk about that. I lost the article, but I'll get to that another day. The U.S. and Israel alliance is rooted in deep defense, security, economic, and investment ties. All sides insist that the U.S. commitment to defense in Israel is unaffected by the unseemly dispute of the last 2 weeks. And with Netanyahu on course to be reelected in March, President Barack Obama will need to find a way to work with him, of course. But the ongoing dispute over the speech seems likely to make that more difficult than ever. To speech, folks. To speech. Smurfs will get their feathers ruffled up about anything. It's just a speech. You didn't ask us. It's just a speech. You went around. It's just a speech. It's a speech. Democrats, you're not in control of Congress anymore. If Boehner wants to ask Netanyahu to come speak to Congress, he's the speaker. Anyway, it's just a speech. Biden has to date missed only one speech by a foreign leader at a joint session of Congress, Ernst said. The vice president really likes his ceremonial duties, he added, but might be busy on March the 3rd. How about that, folks? When Netanyahu is scheduled to deliver his warning to Congress about the U.S. negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program, the Obama administration considers the talks an important diplomatic opening that could lead to the dismantling of Iran's nuclear weapons program. Netanyahu believes Iran has no intention of holding any deal, and U.S. diplomats are being naive. The speech would also come just 2 weeks before the Israeli elections, which widely interpreted as an attempt to rally opposition in Congress, which is considering legislation to try and block the deal. Dermer and Edelstein running around the Hill on Wednesday is symptomatic of what happens as a result of the speaker's invitation and the prime minister's acceptance of the speech, said Martin Edink, a former ambassador to Israel under Bill Clinton. If Dermer really wants to fix the problems created by the speech, goes the consensus among Democrats in Washington, he'll need to do more than just apologize. He and Netanyahu will have to cancel or reschedule the speech. Otherwise, Wednesday won't be the lowest point of the relationship. Wow. It's just a speech. It's going to get worse because Democrats, whether it's a Jewish Democrat congressman or a Jewish voter for the Democrat Party, which is the majority of American Jewish voters, nobody wants to be put in the position of taking sides. Democrats are supporters of Israel, who are supporters of Israel, don't want to have to choose between supporting Israel and supporting their president. Why take sides? It's just a speech. Ernest ducked answering whether Obama would ask Biden to attend the speech. An Oval Office meeting with the president has already been ruled out. That's not a surprise. It's not uncommon either when somebody comes to speak at Congress that they don't get an Oval Office meeting. Ernst acknowledged that Biden's snub might hurt Netanyahu in the Israeli elections on March 17th. We'll see, Ernest said. As we consider the vice president's attendance, that's one of the factors that will weigh on the decision. It's just a speech. Seven Jewish Democrat members of Congress who met Wednesday in Representative Steve Israel's office. He's a Democrat from New York. That includes Debbie Wasserman Schultz from here in Florida, Debbie Blubbermouth Schultz, and Ted Deutsch of Florida, Jerry Nadler and Nina Lowry of New York, Sander Levine of Michigan, and Jan Schakowsky of Illinois. They lit into Dermer. The invitation, they said, was making them choose between Netanyahu and Obama, making support for Israel into a partisan issue that they never wanted it to be, and forcing them to consider a boycott of the speech. It doesn't have to. It's just a speech. Why does it have to be about choosing between Obama and Netanyahu? I don't even hear Obama saying anything here. By the way, three Democrats have come out and said they'll definitely skip the speech. That was news this evening. One member, according to someone in the room, went so far as to tell Dermer it was hard to believe him when he said that he didn't realize that the partisan mess that he was making by going around Obama to get Boehner to make the invitation. It's just a speech. They suggested Netanyahu consider speaking to members of Congress privately and not from the podium of the House. He shouldn't need to. It's just a speech. There were a wide range of new views that were discussed, but one thing we all agree to on emphatically is that Israel should never be used as a political football. That's what Representative Israel told Politico. You don't have to use Israel as a political football. It is just a speech. You all, you Smurfs, are making this political. And that's what happened. As that was happening, a new diplomatic rift was opening. The Israelis sent Edelstein, a member of Netanyahu's Likud party, to meet with Boehner. Boehner's office remembered to invite Pelosi's rival, Minority Whip Steny Hoyer, but left out House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Oh, my goodness. Wow. That's big. A spokesperson for Israel's ambassador didn't return the request for comment. Hoyer and House Foreign Relations Committee ranking member Elliot Engel, who had also been invited, both pulled out when they realized Pelosi was being left out. Man, this is just everybody getting ruffled under the feathers. It's just a speech. Had we been told that Rep. Pelosi had wanted to attend, she certainly would have been welcome, explained Boehner's spokesperson Michael Steele afterwards. By then, the Israeli embassy was scrambling. Pelosi got her own meeting with Edelstein added to the schedule. So they can schedule that, right? Joe Biden will be busy, though. And she brought along Hoyer and Engel, as well as Assistant Democrat Leader Jim Clyburn and Intelligence Committee Ranking Member Adam Schiff. Pelosi's office told Politico Tuesday that she'll go to Netanyahu's speech if it happens. But Wednesday, she used Edelstein's meeting to tear into the Israelis directly. Of course she'll go. It's just a speech. Pelosi expressed concern that casting the political apple of discord into the relationship is not the best way forward with the formidable challenges of two countries are facing. I mean, I got to tell you, folks, it's just a speech. If they'll get bent out of shape over this, can you imagine the things that they'll get bent out of shape over? Pelosi expressed her concern that casting a political... Dermer, meanwhile, scheduled another rush meeting with Engel for Thursday. Nothing that happened Wednesday seemed to have calmed the revolt that dozens of Democrats are considering skipping Netanyahu's speech. Ernst said that the White House can't see why they might. Can even see why they might. They won't. It's just a speech. Individual members of Congress will have to make their own decisions, some of which I assume will be driven by their schedule and some of which will be driven by their own views of what has transpired over the last several weeks as it relates to this speech, Ernest said. Asked whether the president believes that American-Israel relationship should be harmed by Democrats skipping the speech, Ernst ducked that question. The president believes that individual members of Congress will have to decide for themselves. It's just a speech. Oh, my goodness, it's just a speech. Well, that's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. My pond will reopen next week on Monday at 8 p.m. We'll take up issues that we did not get to tonight and yesterday, as well as other things. Check the website to see what's up for Monday night's show, 1111broadcasting.com. I hope you'll join us, and until next week, do what you love and love what you do. Good night, everybody.